how to get into the Harvard Kennedy School, where the bottom line is ROI to society. Hello and welcome. Thanks for joining me for this week's Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in!" And not only in, but in at the best program for you. At the AGAC conference in June, one of my favorite sessions took place at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where the Director of Admissions, Matt Clemens, gave an excellent presentation on the programs provided by Harvard Kennedy School, as well as on what it asks from you if you want to get in. I asked him right after the presentation if he would consider being a guest on the podcast, and he not only considered it, he agreed to join me here today. So I'm thrilled to introduce Matt Clemens, Director of Admissions at Harvard's Kennedy School. Matt, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I'm delighted to have you here. Can you please give an overview of the Harvard Kennedy School Master's in Public Policy program for those listeners who may not be so familiar with it? My understanding is that that's the biggest program offered at the Kennedy School. Is that correct?
Sure, yes. We have four master's programs. The MPP is the largest, and it's a two-year full-time program for people who are early in their careers, who are seeking a strong set of skills to address real-world problems. Work experience plays an important role in both being a wise consumer while in the program, the ability to choose classes based on experience, for example, and also to contribute to the program. It's a professional program. There's a lot of group work. Students will engage with one another, and having work experience is something that adds value to those conversations. Mm-hmm. Also, a professional project is required rather than a traditional academic thesis. So very much a professional program. People do have to take tests and write papers, traditional academic disciplines, of course, but the key focus is on giving people a strong set of skills to solve real-world problems.
Now, you mentioned it's for early career applicants, but that work experience is very important. So how much work experience is typical?
Typically, the average is 3 years of people joining us in the MPP program. We do have people who are older and younger, but 3 years is about where we average.
Okay. And how do the Masters of Public Administration and the Masters of Public Administration International Development differ?
Well, they're very similar in terms of structure. Again, the MPID is a two-year full-time program. I may not have mentioned it in the MPP program, but the MPP program has a core curriculum in the first year. A student may be able to take elective or two, but the core is going to form the foundation of the first year. And in the MPID program, it's very similar. There's a core in the first year. Professional development takes place in the summer between the 2 years, and then there's a professional project in the second year. The thing that differentiates the MPID program is the professional development between the 2 years is going to take place either in a developing country or with a development organization, since the program is focused on international development. Mm-hmm. And the first year is very quantitative in nature. The coursework that an MPID student would complete in the first year is very similar to what a PhD student in economics would study, but
wow,
with practical applications to challenges that are faced in the developing world. So they'll touch on the theories and understand kind of where the theories are coming from, but the ultimate focus of the problem is how do we provide solutions to problems that are facing countries in transitional economies and in a developing world context.
And again, the difference between the MPP and the MPA, I mean, Masters in Public Policy, Masters in Public Administration, what is the difference in focus between those two programs?
Well, I often tell people that the nomenclature or the acronym should not really confuse people. All of our programs, whether they're labeled public administration or public policy, are teaching very similar skill sets. Broadly speaking, it could be said that public administration programs are more of a macro level overview and focus on issues such as management of problems, for example, whereas MPP programs have traditionally been characterized as more technical programs. But students can actually structure their curriculums in a way to focus on either more technical skills or more broad level management skills. So the acronyms themselves, while seemingly different, oftentimes the programs are very similar, and students can kind of tailor the coursework beyond the core on the set of skills that they would like to develop in order to address problems they see and to guide their pathways going forward after they graduate.
And HKS also has a program for mid-career folks, right? And is that,
we do.
Is that, that's a one-year program, correct?
Correct. It's 11 months.
And it's, but it's a one-year full-time program.
Correct.
And I guess those are people perhaps with business backgrounds who want to go in more of a policy direction or like that?
It's definitely a mix. We do have people who have been public servants who are looking to come and retool and network and possibly go back into the public sector. But then we do see people who are seeking to transition either from a private sector background into a public sector background, or in some cases there are some people who feel like they've worked within government for a while and they want to enter into the private sector to try to make a difference there. So we definitely see both sides of it. The one requirement is that individuals possess at least 7 years of full-time work experience to apply to that program, and the average number of years of work experience is 13.
Well, so very experienced then.
Yeah.
Now, you have concurrent degree programs with HBS and HLS, correct?
Correct.
And those programs are really famous for use of the case method. Is Harvard Kennedy School also predominantly a case-based school, or does it use a mix of pedagogical methods?
It's definitely a mix. Mm-hmm. Our faculty encourage to teach to their strengths. And the Kennedy School does produce more public policy and public administration cases than any other policy school around. And since they're developed by a lot of our faculty, they're obviously going to be very good at teaching it since they develop those cases.
Sure.
But it's not like, for example, at the business school where applicants are going to be told that if you choose the business school over another program like, let's say, MIT Sloan, which is down the street, that it's going to be case method, case method, case method for the core curriculum at HBS, whereas at the Kennedy School, you definitely will encounter cases in the classroom, but it's not a program that we would say is predominantly case method as far as the teaching style.
Right. Now, how does the MPP differ from the MBA? This is something you addressed at the AGAC conference, I think, really clearly, and I think it's sometimes a point of confusion.
Yeah, so policy school degrees are going to focus on giving candidates the tools to manage policies, to advocate and communicate strategies that impact people and populations. The skill sets that one is going to learn in a policy school are very similar to what one would learn in a business school program. We're going to teach economics, policy analysis, and quantitative analysis, for example. And in the business school program, you're going to study finance, financial reporting, things that are focused really on measuring the bottom line. Are you delivering services? Are you delivering products that are making a profit and returning profit to the shareholders and keeping the business a going concern are kind of the terms that would be used in a business program. And for someone in a policy program, the return on investment is really to society and to either populations in need or regional issues or global issues. For example, wanting to ensure a stable global economy. How can we implement rules and regulations that are going to promote business but at the same time put in checks and balances such that if there are abuses that take place, we can hopefully keep it from causing damage beyond a limited scope. I think you look no further than 2007 and 2008 to see what can happen there. So the example I think I used at the conference was if you're at the business school and you're studying the case method and you're studying a mode of transportation, let's say Harley-Davidson Motorcycle is a company that wants to sell more motorcycles and they want to compete in a crowded marketplace and they want to differentiate themselves amongst their competition, that is a case study that was highlighted when I did a little tour of of the business school. And what immediately came to mind is that we have a case study on Hubway, which is a bicycle sharing system in Boston. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking at two pieces of transportation. One is a private company trying to compete in a crowded marketplace. And you could say that Hubway is also trying to compete in a crowded marketplace of individual automobile ownership, of the MTA with buses and subway and whatnot. And so what you're going to be studying in the case study at the Kennedy School is using the critical fractile method to decide how much inventory to stock when you can only order once and you can't adjust your order frequency size or response. Mm-hmm. So not to go too much into detail, but when you're in a case study in a business program, obviously the focus is on managing that company effectively. And when you're in a policy school, it's managing policies and agencies in order to have an outcome that's going to benefit society. So we also include coursework in management and in negotiations, which are also going to be a part of a business school program. But we also have coursework in politics as well as policy analysis, which may be a little bit different than someone may encounter in a business program, but teaching a similar set of skills in terms of the ability to analyze problems and try to solve them.
Great, thank you. Now, you have a lot of options in terms of concurrent degree programs, joint degree programs. The joint ones are within Harvard. The concurrent degree programs are both in some schools at Harvard and with differing law schools. Business schools include MIT Sloan Wharton Tuck and Stanford, and the medical school is UCSF. And then there was a long list of law schools, I think 10 law schools. For the MBA, let's talk about that person. Why would an MBA want both degrees?
Sure. So the intersection of business and government is one that students are expressing a lot more interest in, and also people who are interested in being social entrepreneurs. They want to go outside of the traditional channels of either nonprofits that have existed for a long time or governments, which sometimes can be inefficient and bureaucratic, and they want to create their own opportunities. They want to make a difference in society, but they want to have their own startup. And so we actually have a new fellowship that specifically focuses on that. It's a social innovation fellowship, and it actually provides up to $30,000 to students to start their own social innovation company in order to make an impact. And obviously business skills can be a very good thing to have in terms of managing a business, and also the policy skill set of how this business is going to interact with the government, with rules and regulations that are in place. And policy professionals should have the ability to kind of address issues across a wide spectrum, and to speak to people in the legal field and in the government, mm-hmm. and to be able to operate on the business playing field all at the same time. And so we do see a lot of interest in people who are seeking that dual skill set.
And can you give an overview of how, let's say, a concurrent degree program works? Not so much the ones within Harvard, but let's say the one, you know, HKS and Wharton, or HKS and especially Stanford, when, you know, Stanford's on the other side of the country, HKS and MIT, a little bit more convenient.
Sure. So as far as the application process, I can actually say that all of the programs, whether they're within Harvard or outside, require a separate application to each school, and there's no joint committee of any kind. So even though we share programs, joint programs with Harvard Law and with Harvard Business, and I know Chad Losey and Tom Robinson, who are the directors of those two schools, and we'll get together and talk sometimes socially or about business, or we'll even travel together, but we don't have a time where we sit down and review applications together and make decisions. And it would be the same way with Stanford or Wharton or Tuck or MIT. I'm very friendly with the directors at many of those schools, and we'll exchange emails with them on a variety of different topics, but never do we sit down and say, let's look at the pool of people who have applied jointly or concurrently to our two programs and make decisions. So in the example of MIT, Rod Garcia and his team mm-hmm. would make their own decision, and me and my team would make our own decision. And if an applicant happens to be admitted to both programs, they can then inform us of where they would like to start and that they would like to engage in the concurrent program, and we have them sign a contract, getting an understanding of what the setup of the program is going to be and whatnot. But the application processes are entirely separate, no matter whether it's within Harvard or with one of our partners outside of the university.
Okay. And if somebody's admitted to, let's say, HKS and not to MIT, to use the example that you were given, then they would just go to HKS. And if they wanted to pursue an MBA later, they would pursue it later. And if not, they would just do it with the MPP, presumably, from HKS, right?
Yeah, and the advantage of applying to both programs at the same time is if you're admitted to both, then you can start. If you're not admitted to one program and you are admitted to the other, for example, let's say somebody was admitted to the Kennedy School but not admitted to Sloan, they would still have an opportunity to apply to Sloan again in their first year at HKS if they wish to do that. So they would actually have two opportunities. The only program where that's not the case is with the Harvard Business School. The Harvard Business School does require that one possess an admission offer from each school at the same time, and the reason for that is there's a special joint seminar that is taught in the first year at the Kennedy School, where a business school professor will come over and teach the cohort of joint students, and then in the second year a Kennedy School professor will go travel over to HBS and do the same thing. So the HBS program,
it's a long
mandate.
Trip.
Yeah, across a bridge.
Right.
And then MIT's two subway stops. Certainly the journey to Tuck, Wharton, or Stanford is a little longer, but the palm trees in California are certainly appealing considering the winters in Cambridge.
Yeah.
But needless to say that, you know, the application, again, is separate for each school, but if someone is not admitted to one program and admitted to another, they would have another opportunity to apply in their first year. Except for the case of the Harvard Business School.
Right. And actually, that isn't one of the differences between the concurrent programs and the joint program. Is the joint program, you have some classes that are specifically for people in the joint program, whereas with the concurrent programs, you're taking advantage of both schools' opportunities. You're going to end up with a degree from both schools, but there are no courses in either place geared specifically for people participating in that program.
That's correct.
Where do graduates of HKS get jobs? What do they do once they leave?
Well, the thing I typically say is there's no such thing as typical. And if you look at our career statistics, and they are available on our website, it's not exactly a third. But it's close every year. About a third of our graduates, 6 months after they graduate, we send out a survey, we get the data back, and we publish an annual report. And about a third, once they leave, are working in the public sector, about a third in the not-for-profit, and about a third in the private sector. So it is possible for people to use the skill set we teach and to go into a lot of different directions. And there's always a story underneath the story as well. For example, one of the graduates of the MIT Sloan HKS program is currently working for Deloitte, and so she would be considered to be working in the private sector. However, she's working on a public sector project within Deloitte that's focusing on public school systems. And so behind the scenes, a lot of the students who are actually in the private sector are working on projects that have a public sector focus or are more policy focused.
That makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. And do a lot of your grads over the course of their career, do you see them kind of working some of the time in government, some of the time in the private sector, or basically at some point in time in either one?
Yeah, one of my favorite examples is a mid-career graduate by the name of Dave Morehouse. And he had a career in the White House, the Pentagon, and Capitol Hill. And now he is the CEO of the Stanley Cup champion Pittsburgh Penguins. And
oh,
so
wow.
He's someone who spent a career in government, and now he is leading a major sports organization. And one of the things he's known for is developing a strong bond between the franchise and between the local community, community relations and whatnot. That's part of his legacy there. And so it is quite common. That's kind of an unusual example, I think.
Yeah.
But it is quite common for me to meet an alum or to talk to an alum who tells me a story about, you know, working in a particular sector after leaving the Kennedy School, but having jumped around in the years that they've been out of the school. So it's pretty it's a pretty common theme. Some people will work within the government and become frustrated with it, and they'll say, you know, I'm going to go out and I'm going to start my own thing, or I'm going to work in the private sector to try and make a difference. And there's some people who work in the private sector and think, wow, I really need to go into the government because I need to change things, and so I'm going to use the skills that I've developed here and the mentality and go work in the public sector.
Okay. And can you give me an example? Let's say this, I assume the person that you mentioned, you know, graduated, you know, a decade or more ago, probably a couple decades ago. Can you give me an example, let's say, of a recent graduate whose story maybe typifies, if you will, the opportunity that the Kennedy School of Government opened up for them?
Sure. So one of the stories I like to share is about a student who joined us from the private sector. Her name is Catherine Lusk, and she worked in marketing and consulting before she came to the Kennedy School.
Mm-hmm.
And when she joined us, one of the things that she was interested in was working for the government in the public sector, and she ended up getting a job in the mayor's office under the administration of Thomas Menino.
Was that in Boston?
In Boston, yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And she was appointed to a task force related to the relationship that citizens had with their government and trying to get people better access to the services of the government. And so she was tasked with that project, ended up leading what's called City Hall to Go. They took an old SWAT van that wasn't being used, and they equipped it as a mobile government office. And I'm happy to say, I actually just recently learned, they developed one when Catherine got started. Now they have two. Mm. And if you've ever been to Boston, it's not the easiest city to drive in.
Right.
Certainly expensive to park. City Hall is not exactly an eye-appealing building, so why make the citizens come down to City Hall and take care of things? And so now the government will come to you. And,
oh, wow.
And Catherine was responsible for that. Like I said, it's grown. They actually have two trucks. And she is still working for the mayor's office, Catherine, and she is working on a pay equity initiative. Now she's moved on from the City Hall to Go project, but is still doing wonderful work within the mayor's office working on pay equity. So she graduated in 2012 and decided to stay within the Boston area and is working in local government right now, but had a private sector background before joining the Kennedy School.
Very interesting. Yeah, okay. A very interesting story. You would think, especially in cities, well, Boston, you don't have the urban sprawl that you have in LA, okay? But still, mm-hmm. going downtown is a royal pain in Los Angeles. I go downtown mm-hmm. as seldom as possible. And it's a brilliant idea to say, okay, City Hall is going to go to this suburb on this and this date, or this neighborhood on this and this date. You can take mm-hmm. care of what you got to take care of, and probably much less expensively. Yeah, it sounds like such a simple idea and such a good idea. Okay, let's turn to admissions. That's really your area of specialty. What is the Kennedy School looking for in applicants?
Sure, there's really four things, no matter the program one is applying to. One is a commitment to public service. We want to see people who not only say they want to be involved in public service, but they actually have a track record of doing so. So being involved not only in their own self-development, but in promoting policies or being involved in communities or mentoring others, basically wanting to contribute to society in a meaningful way and having demonstrated that. Two is a leadership track record. We really are looking for individuals who have already kind of established themselves as leaders, and there's definitely many different leadership styles, so it's not just someone's title, but it's how they're involved in projects and the contributions that they make, and those who write letters of recommendation oftentimes complement the leadership story that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. We also look for quantitative aptitude, of the ability to deal with numbers. We're not looking for people who are math majors or econ majors necessarily, but everyone's going to have to take some quantitative courses, and so we're looking for a ability to learn what we teach. And then finally, we're looking for work experience. It is possible for people to be admitted with little to no work experience, but most often those individuals have been selected for a very competitive and self-selective or very selective program like what's called the Pickering Foreign Affairs program where the government actually chooses you in your junior year of college, and then they require you to go directly into a graduate program. And when you leave, you become a foreign service officer.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody has a very direct pathway into something that they're doing, we have a high level of confidence that they're going to do well in the program because they're going to be really focused. But what we don't want to do is get someone to the program who's still trying to figure things out. We don't expect everybody to be fully baked when they get here, but we certainly want them to be making decisions based upon work experience in the real world as opposed to maybe a 3-month internship that they've had as an undergrad.
What about tests and grades and that kind of stuff?
Well, we certainly, I go back to the theme, there's really two things that we're trying to figure out as an admissions committee. One is, can you learn what we teach?
Right.
And two is, do you fit the DNA of what the Kennedy School is about? And being a school of public service, that doesn't mean we're trying to produce people who are going to be the best academics, the best researchers, the best writers. That would be for people who are interested in our PhD programs.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be some students who come into the program who are more maybe research or theory oriented, but they're really looking for a practical application of skills in the world as well. So in terms of test scores and in terms of grades, it doesn't mean a lot if you have really strong grades and strong test scores without a commitment to public service, demonstrated commitment to public service, and a leadership track record like I talked about.
Right.
So we're looking for solid grades. We're looking for solid test scores, but we don't have GPA cutoffs. We don't have test score cutoffs. We do look for ranges, for example, on the GRE or the GMAT, and we're agnostic. We'll take either. We like to see a score in the top third.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, if I'm evaluating a candidate, and we do look at each individual section rather than a cumulative score. So if we're looking at the Q section and one candidate has a score in the 75th percentile and another the 85th percentile, I'm not necessarily going to be more impressed by the candidate who scored in the 85th percentile. I'm going to kind of look at both of them and say, yeah, they could both do the work in the program, or we have a high level of comfort with a score in that range. Now let's dig into the resume and look for their leadership record and their service record to figure out if they fit that DNA component of what the Kennedy School is about. So I won't say that grades and test scores aren't important. They certainly are, in the sense that, again, we want to make sure that people can do the work in the program, but it's not the critical component in admissions or something that puts someone over the top. We definitely place a bit more emphasis on the likely impact that someone is going to have on the world when they leave the program over possessing a 4.0 GPA or something like that.
Got it. So the grades and stats that applicants sometimes stress over are more or less a threshold. They're necessary but insufficient for admission. And what's really going to get them in is the other stuff that you mentioned before I asked about tests and grades.
Yeah, and one thing that business schools do that we don't, oftentimes business and law schools do, is they will publish average GPAs and average test scores, and we're really not in the business of doing that because we don't want people to get it fixed into their mind that, oh, if I don't score at this level or if I don't have this GPA, then I'm not going to get in, or I shouldn't even try. And it's, again, it's not how we make decisions. There's also a lot behind the story of grades For example, often people will be involved in honors programs, or they'll take a very rigorous curriculum. So you could have candidate A who is in an honors program and is in taking very high-level calculus courses, and you could have candidate B who maybe has a higher GPA but wasn't in an honors program and was taking more basic mathematics courses. And obviously, in that instance, candidate A has a story to tell behind why maybe their GPA is lower, because of the strength of their schedule. And we really don't feel like statistics published on a website are going to do an adequate job of telling that story.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. Yeah, you have an excellent blog. I believe you're the author of the blog. Am I correct? Or is it somebody else?
Yeah, most of the blog is my contribution, but we also have staff, alumni, students, and faculty who will also contribute. But you could say I'm the man behind the blog, so to speak.
Okay. So there was a post, you have a series now on applying for the 2016-17 cycle, and one of your posts was about pause points in the evaluation process. What are the top pause points when you review an application? And I'm going to link to the blog post also from accepted.com/167.
Sure. So I guess I should also say about the Kennedy School, 50% of our students approximately are international. And for many of those candidates, English is not their first language. And so for candidates who are in that position, we're going to be paying particular attention to their English abilities because we want to make sure that they can keep up with the pace. For all applicants, math and quantitative abilities are going to be important to us because, again, we do want people to be able to learn what we teach. And one of the things about the Kennedy School is it's a very extracurricular experience. The classes are definitely very rewarding and wonderful, but oftentimes when you speak to students and alumni, they talk about all of the activities that are available, all the speakers, all the lunches, all the conferences that are going on. And the best way to disadvantage yourself if you come into the program is to be struggling in your econ or quant class by having to get a tutor or to spend a lot of extra time out of class catching up when the rest of your classmates are taking in all of these wonderful activities and bragging about them. And so the quantitative background is something that we'll pay attention to. And each one of our programs is going to ask for either a quantitative resume or a quantitative statement of some kind. And we do provide examples and information on the blog about what we're looking for. We don't want people to have to guess about those things. And then commitment to public service. We do have applicants who are coming from the private sector, and we value that. We do feel that bringing that set of skills or that background into our community is a good thing. But we're also looking for a section on the resume and for maybe recommenders to talk about service and leadership and community involvement, mentorship, those sorts of themes we really like to see. So if somebody doesn't really, their compass really isn't pointed in the public service direction, that kind of causes us to pause a little. So those would be the top things.
Okay, great. When is your application going live and when is the final deadline?
So we're shooting for early September. We don't have a specific date. We're making some adjustments, and we're not sure how long technically it's going to take us. But it'll be early September, and unlike business schools, which typically have rounds, we're just a single round. We'll open probably within the first week of September. Our deadline will be December 1st, and then we will release decisions for all programs on a single date in March. Although we don't note the specific date, it's typically the second week of March. And we try to alleviate the stress that applicants feel through the blog. In the fall we provide lots of good advice about putting the application together, and then I don't like it to be a black hole after the deadline passes. I like to provide lots of updates about what's going on and how close we're getting, and so applicants definitely have the opportunity to get a glimpse of what's happening through following the blog.
Okay. Is it advantageous to apply early in the application cycle, or do you review all applications after the deadline?
It's not advantageous in the sense that we don't start reviewing applications until after the deadline passes. Okay. It's certainly advantageous not to wait until the last minute.
Yes.
Because there's obviously complications that occur. One of the things I'll publish on the blog every year is a graph of what's happening in our system around the application deadline. And typically about 70% of the people submit their application within the last 70, 72 hours before the deadline. So you see this graph that's a little drib and drabble here and there, and then it just skyrockets straight up.
Yeah.
Much like what the IRS probably sees on tax day. But we don't start reviewing applications until after the deadline passes.
Yeah. Well, I think if you're within the first of those last 72 hours, you're probably okay. But when you're in the last 72 minutes, you're, I think, living very dangerously. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, well, me and a staff member, every year we stay up until midnight, the deadline, and I'm at home and she's, you know, at her home, and we're both on our computers and we have our chat windows open and we're watching what's going on. Emails are hitting our account and people are having questions. So it's a late night. It's kind of a ritual that we engage in, and it always makes us laugh because it happens every year.
Right, right. Yeah, we have similar experience. What are some common mistakes applicants make when applying to the Harvard Kennedy School?
Well, the biggest mistake is really just not following instructions. It's true that our application instructions are pretty long, but they're long for a reason. They're pretty detailed. And I can say one of my pet peeves, both for applicants and for prospects who are just kind of snooping around about the programs, is to ask questions that are clearly answered within the instructions or are clearly answered on our website. It just kind of shows a lack of research. I don't mean to discourage anyone from contacting us, but when they contact us and ask a question that's fairly basic, like how many letters of recommendation do you require? And it specifically says on our website and it says in our instructions. It's just one of those simple things that they could ascertain on their own. I try to provide lots of good advice on the blog about what we like to see and what we don't like to see. And the joke I typically make, and students will sometimes quote it back to me, is one thing you don't want to do in your personal statement or in your essay responses is to quote Gandhi. And typically, you know, generates a little bit of laugh when I'm giving an information session and I say that, but it's true. So many people will say in their statement that they wish to be the change they want to see in the world, which is a famous Gandhi quote, but I always tell people I'm not looking to admit Gandhi to the Kennedy School. I'm looking to admit you. And so I'm not interested in what Gandhi said. I'm interested in what you have to say. So it's not necessarily a mistake that people would make, but I try to provide guidance and wisdom on those kind of simple things. Or sometimes people will, in their essays, talk. Yeah, or yeah, Kennedy would be another one. But they will quote or they will note what undergraduate institution they attended in one of their essays. And not only is it on their resume, I also have their academic transcript. So I'm very aware of where they went to school. They don't need to let me know a third time. So, you know, those are some common things that aren't necessarily mistakes. They're just kind of things that people might not think about and through no fault of their own. They haven't really put on the lens of an admissions committee member. And I try to be transparent. I want to tell them, you know, what do we look for? What are things that you can do to improve your application and sum it up with that. Yeah.
Okay. We always advise applicants to think about the application as a jigsaw puzzle, and every element is a piece, and you want it to all fit together with no overlap, really, or minimal overlap. So that, I think, speaks to...
That's an excellent way to put it.
Yeah. That's the concept. And in terms of quoting, you actually mentioned that at the conference also. So I thought it was also something worth mentioning here. What would you have liked me to ask you?
Well, I guess part of working for Harvard that's a challenge is when I approach people or people approach me and they ask me what I do and they find out, they say, well, you must have the easiest job in the world. Everybody wants to go to Harvard. Well, it's true and not true, because people let the name Harvard scare them away. They think, oh, I'm not good enough, I'll never get in, or it's too expensive, I can't afford it. And I guess asking me about my background, because I'm not shy about who I am and where I've come from, and I tell people, and actually I think in the presentation that I gave you, it's similar to what I do with applicants. I show my very first name tag from my very first job, which was a fry cook at a Dairy Queen. And I went to a public high school. I saved money for college by working in a fast food restaurant. I you know, borrowed money to go to a small liberal arts school. And now I decide who gets into Harvard, which is kind of crazy, because I grew up in Portland, Oregon, which is about as far away in the continental United States as you can get from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And I never really had it on my mind that one day I would be working for an institution like Harvard, but I worked hard. I had a very supportive family, a loving wife, and I wasn't afraid to throw my hat into the ring when the opportunity presented itself. So I oftentimes like to share that story, and also the story of also being rejected from the U.S. Peace Corps. I applied to the Peace Corps and I was rejected. And it was actually the best thing that ever happened to me, because instead of joining the Peace Corps, I ended up teaching English in Korea, and that's where I met my wife.
Uh-huh.
And so the rejection from the Peace Corps was actually the best thing that could have happened to me, because I met the love of my life. So it just kind of wraps up a story of saying, hey, you should definitely try. If you think you can make it, you should you miss 100% of the chances you don't take. So don't let the name intimidate you. We do have close to $25 million in financial aid, so you may receive some financial aid from us as well. And the worst thing we can say is no, and just because we say no, it doesn't mean you don't have a bright future ahead and other wonderful doors will open. So
Right. A lot of times, if like you say, many things, if you don't try, you don't ask, then it's an automatic no. And if you try, you can at least say that you tried, and you might actually get the answer you're hoping for. So that's a great story.
Exactly.
It's a great story. Thank you so much for sharing. And also the perspective that certainly many times in my life, my husband's life, things seemingly happened in ways that we didn't want. And you know what? It really, really worked out for the best. So.
Yeah, very, very true.
Sometimes you have to make it work out for the best, but frequently it does. Mm-hmm. So anyways, Matt, I want to thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your insight and information about the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Where can listeners and potential applicants learn more about HKS's programs?
Well, the best resource I've mentioned a couple of times, that would be the admissions blog. We try to provide very relevant content that's seasonal during the fall, how to put together a good application. After the deadline passes, we're going to keep you up to date. And we do try to provide content from our students and alumni as well. There's a series running right now on what our students are doing during the summer in terms of their professional development. We also dipped our toe into the Twitter waters recently. We started an account a couple of months ago, so they can follow us both on our Tumblr blog, which is just, you Google HKS admissions blog and it will be the first thing you see.
We're
and then the
that.
Twitter handle.
What is the Twitter?
HKS.
At HKS?
It's at HKS admissions.
Okay, great. All right, we'll link to all that from the show notes at exhibit.com/167. And we'll also link to some related articles and show notes. Listener, thank you too for joining Matt Clemens and me for our 167th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please tell your friends about the useful, informative podcast that you've been listening to. I thank you, and so will your friends. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.